Welcome to Cardboard Cinema Club Podcast, the film podcast in which two people talk about a film they both love. I don't know why nobody's thought of it before. Today I'm joined by editor, author and real-life Canadian, Shannon Fay, and we're here to discuss Edgar Wright's 2004 horror comedy classic, Shaun of the Dead. Shannon, how are you?
I'm great. Yeah, very happy to be here discussing Shaun of the Dead with you.
It's good to have you here.
I know,
So for anyone who might be listening who hasn't seen it, can you give us a very quick overview of the premise?
So Shaun, played by Simon Pegg, he is a 27-year-old retail worker. His girlfriend, Liz, is getting a bit fed up with how they just seem to spend all their date nights in the pub with their friends, specifically Shaun's slacker friend, Ed, and also Liz's roommates, Diane, and oh no, what's it? David.
David, yes.
With Di and David through some miscommunications and basically ineptitude on Shaun's part. He messes up a big date that they're supposed to have, causing Liz to dump him.
It's the make or break date night.
Shaun, he is determined to win Liz back, but before he can figure out how he's going to do that, the dead walk the earth. A zombie apocalypse has happened, and London is under siege by zombies. So Shaun, his friend Ed, they have to go rescue Shaun's mother and stepfather, as well as Liz and her roommates, find a place to buckle down, which in this case is obviously the pub, the Winchester. But when zombies then converge on that location, everything builds into a somewhat bittersweet climax.
Yes. Hopefully people have seen this and know how it all turns out. So do you remember when you first saw it and how you felt about it when you first saw it?
It's tough because I don't quite remember the very first time I watched it, but I can remember the lead up to it because this film came out in 2004. So I would have been 16 turning 17. And I remember seeing the hype for it both online on film sites that I frequented at the time. And also in real life at the comic book store I would hang out at, right? And so eventually when my local comic book store had a DVD of it for sale, I grabbed it. I can't remember when I would have like sat down to watch it for that first time. But I know that in the years that followed, it was the movie where if a friend of mine said that they hadn't seen Shaun of the Dead, I'd say, oh, we have to watch it. And I'd put my DVD in, right? So for a couple of years, I'm pretty sure I watched this film several times a year and would not get bored of it. I was one of those annoying teens who I had decided film was going to be my thing, right?
I think I was one of those annoying teens as well, and yeah. Still am.
In my case, my family, when I was a teen, we moved around a lot, right? So it's like, oh, can't quite get into athletics, can't quite get into some kind of like art, but film will move around with you, right? Film, you can watch by yourself or with your siblings, and with the internet, you could then like read other people's takes, learn about upcoming films. So Shaun of the Dead, for me, came at a time when I was, like, really, really thinking about these things. And also, it offered a glimpse of adulthood for teenage me, right? Which was appealing. I mean, not to say, like, obviously there are other films featuring kind of adult slackers, like, say, Clerks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But this might have been one of the first ones I'd seen. And so it was interesting to see that kind of a view of adulthood. And then as I grew older, it's like there comes a point where it's like, oh, I'm Sean's age now, right? And now that I'm older than Sean, you know, it's like, oh, he's younger than me now. And so not to make this sound too grand a statement about a horror comedy, but there's some art where it almost feels like the needle on a sundial. It stays in place, but you move in relation around it. So
that makes perfect sense.
Your position to it changes, right?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I know what you mean. And it is interesting seeing them get younger into the distance. As you get older, they get relatively younger to you. Instead, who are these children? I saw it when it came out originally at the cinema, and I think I must have fairly recently seen Spaced for the first time. Oh. I think I had seen Spaced when I watched it, because I didn't watch Spaced for a long time. Mm-hmm. I didn't watch it when it came out, and the reason was because back in those days I was still wanting comedy writing for television to be my thing, and I'd been working on a surreal deconstructionist flat chair sitcom as well.
Ooh, yeah.
So I was just furious with jealousy, essentially, that they'd got there first. I didn't know anything about it, but I heard it was surreal and weird and kind of deconstructed the format, and I was shaking my fist at the sky.
Yeah.
Basil Fawlty style, going, that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And it turned out, actually, it's completely different.
That's usually
and I loved
the case.
It when I saw it.
Yeah.
Although, and again, completely independently, and it's maybe being a young adult in the 90s, but I also had a character, one of the main central characters in my case, who was always mashed on various pills. And I also had the gag of him dancing to the telephone. He just danced to any rhythmic sound.
Nice.
He'd think he's at a rave.
Yeah. So, hey, that character also shows up in Shaun of the Dead.
He does, yes. Yeah. He's the only actual character to cross over between the two.
Yeah.
Tyres, played by Michael Smiley, or I think you always have to say it, Michael Smiley.
I love that actor, but he pretty much terrifies me on sight now. I've seen him in too many scary roles.
He's good at playing utterly terrifying characters, isn't he? If Michael Smiley's in a film, it's probably a Ben Wheatley film. Mm. But if he's in a film that's not a Ben Wheatley film, I think he's also a good mark of quality. I think the first role outside of Spaced, outside of a light comedy, that I saw him in was Kill List.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that, but it looks too,
it's intense.
Yeah. No, he plays a sinister figure in a Black Mirror episode, and that is,
He's very good at both. He's very good at light comedy and very good at being intensely dark. But yes, I saw this film, I think, having recently seen Spaced, and being a little trepidatious. I think I'd heard good things about it. I mean, it's 18 years ago now, so I don't remember the exact details, but I was trepidatious because at that time, the idea of a British sitcom spinning off onto the big screen was still seen as probably not a good idea. And even though, unlike earlier attempts like Holiday on the Buses and all the Porridge movie and all those other 70s ones, this one's not a direct spin-off.
No.
It's not the same characters, although it would be quite fun if it was.
Seeing
Tim and Daisy in a full-on actual zombie apocalypse. It's kind of a spin-off from one particular scene in one episode of Spaced.
Well, they could show up with a tank, right?
Yes. So I was trepidatious going in because of how British sitcoms usually fared on the big screen. And also, I think at that time, there weren't that many great British films. It was possibly a little bit of a lull around about 2004. I might be wrong. I'd have to go back and
look.
Well,
because for me, I see it in the frame of kind of zombie resurgence. And this came out just 2 years after 28 Days Later, which, you know, I consider a British film, right? British director, British setting, you know? And I was thinking of rewatching it, that film, to kind of get ready for this. But I did not. I rewatched Last Night in Soho instead. And anyway, but I remember really liking 28 Days Later. And I think it kind of weirdly paving the way for Shaun of the Dead, right?
Yes, I think so. And we'll probably get onto that because I've made notes about the two different flavours of zombie that you get.
Yeah.
But yes, I saw this at the cinema. And this was one of the very rare occasions. Normally, if there's a film that I really like, I'll be enjoying it all the way through, but it'll be by the end, the film's finished, and I go, I really like that film. That was a great film. Mm-hmm. In the case of Shaun of the Dead, it was by the moment when Shaun is demonstrating, he's kind of rather sort of lazily and absently demonstrating televisions to the couple. In his shop.
Yeah.
And he's flicking through the channels and you're seeing all the news reports flashing by or something, and no one's noticed yet. I timed it. It takes exactly 30 minutes until any of the central characters notice that there's something going on.
Ah, but there's so many good scenes of dread. I like the bit with the homeless man in the park, or you see
grabbing the pigeons.
Yeah, or some random man running panicked in the street.
And I remember it was specifically that scene of him flicking through the channels and not really noticing on the TV in his shop. That's the moment I thought, I love this film. No matter what happens now, I know this film is going to be great. It's doing this expertly. And I think it's so easy to do a horror comedy badly. And I talked about this with Alex in the American Werewolf in London episode. I think you have to be really clever and you have to take care of the atmosphere and the tone, and you have to make it eerie.
Yeah.
Rather than just, here's some jokes, here's some violence, yuck. If you're not as clever as Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, it's easy to do a flat kind of zombies, wee.
I also appreciate, like, in the deleted scenes, Edgar Wright kind of breaks down some of, like, the overall vision. Like, they deleted some scenes, some comedic jokes where they're like, no, the zombies should never be, like, the source of the jokes. They should never be funny in themselves, because they should always be a threat, right?
Yes.
The comedy kind of has to come from elsewhere. So I think that is a good kind of guiding point to help make the horror comedy elements.
It's specifically the bit that they had the zombies looking like the meerkats on the Neighborhood Watch sign.
Yeah.
So you see the Neighborhood Watch sign, and if you don't know that, it's a bit odd that the camera kind of lingers on the Neighborhood Watch sign, but then there's a bit where the zombies are looking like the
meerkats. Yeah.
And rightfully, I think he took that out. Because it does make the zombies look a bit silly, and they have to be proper zombies.
And I think there are some jokes relating to the hint of an idea that even zombified, they retain some elements of their human personality. They really, like, they don't dwell on it, but there's the joke of Shaun saying to his mom, there's nothing of your husband left in there. As then zombie Bill Nye turns off the music that he was detested, and even gives a kind of zombie sigh of relief, right?
Yes.
Or they talk about the zombie of the lonely woman in the pub, right? She really seems to actually hate them, right? Like, it seems to go beyond mere, like, zombie hunger, and it's personal. Probably because she heard about these two lads cracking jokes at her expense, right? Maybe every other night. So.
Have you seen the original Dawn of the Dead, the 1978?
But of course, long after I watched this movie. So as a teen, I would not have gotten any of the references. But yes, yeah.
Because I think that's one of the central ideas of that the reason that there's so many zombies at the shopping mall is that there's some small part of them.
Yeah, it's what they knew in life, yeah.
So I think they're kind of running with that idea. Personally, I mean, it's a taste thing, but personally for me, the two best zombie films ever is a toss-up between Dawn of the Dead and Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, okay. Oh, this is a little bit of a sidetrack, but in my Canadian DVD, it has to have French and English on it, right? So I'm a little sad because the French title does not retain the Dawn of the Dead, Shaun of the Dead pun, right?
Oh.
Because it's another language.
Of course. So what's the French
Jean title? Et les zombies. Which, I don't know, maybe that's a pun in French. Maybe it's a play on some title, you know, some like new wave film I've never heard of, right?
Yes.
Yeah, let's see. Favorites? I mean, Shaun of the Dead pretty up there. I've always got a soft spot for Day of the Dead. I don't know, I think at the time I just wanted to be like, oh, everyone likes Dawn of the Dead, but Day of the Dead is the underrated Romero film. I think it's got, like, nearly like a nearly flawless first 15 minutes, how it goes from dream sequence to the hello, is anyone alive out there, Florida streets, to the descent in the bunker. It's not flawless all the way through, but I think like that flow and the character dialogue, where, you know, sorry for this Day of the Dead tangent, but it needs all the champions it can get.
No, that's fair enough. The reason that Dawn of the Dead wins out for me over Night of the Living Dead and Day of the Dead is just absence of zombie action in Live First and Third. There's plenty of zombiness and zombie hijinks and goings on in Dawn of the Dead to keep you satisfied, but they get marginalised quite a bit in Day of the Dead. Night of the Living Dead is more about the characters being holed up and
sure,
their unpleasant interactions with each other.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. So, like, I do think it's a great movie. And now that I'm older and, you know, can finally admit to more conventional opinions, it probably is the better movie, right? Yeah. An actual good movie on its own.
So this is a very British film, obviously, and I think part of the reason it works so well is that it's taking the Britishness and running with it. So
I do remember at the time seeing a review where the title of the review was "No Zombies, Please, We're British."
Excuse me. Hello.
Oi!
Hey. Oh my God. She's so drunk.
Aren't you yet, love? Oh. She likes you. Shut up. And she wants a cuddle.
Listen, I'm serious. I've just come out of a relationship.
Do something!
Wait there.
Ed!
2 seconds.
Jeez, look, I'm really flat and everything, really, but I just...
And hold it there.
Just get off me!
And it does. One of the notes I made was that it actually feels more like John Wyndham than George Romero.
Okay.
So I think George Romero zombies, he's from Philadelphia and they're set and filmed in Philadelphia.
Hey, Romero's also had Canadian citizenship. We claim him as our own. He was only able to make those like later in life movies because I'm pretty sure government funding. So
actually, I think Dawn of the Dead has a slight Canadian bleakness. There's something almost. I was watching Scanners the day before yesterday, and that almost has a similar feel to Dawn of the Dead.
Something
about the picture quality.
Yeah.
The chilliness that you wouldn't necessarily associate with American films.
Mm, yeah.
So I think there is a Canadian feel to it, now you mention it. And I think Shaun of the Dead doesn't feel at all like a George Romero film.
No.
And it's much more like John Wyndham. It's much more like Day of the Triffids. Mm. And it was actually seeing Day of the Triffids, the 1981 BBC adaptation at the time when I was 6 or 7 and far too young to be watching such things, and finding it really eerie and scary. That I think that is the reason that I connect to the slow moving zombies. I think the fast moving zombies are fine and they're scary.
Yes.
I mean, they make you panic. It's very claustrophobic having these things chasing you.
Yeah, it gets your adrenaline pumping for sure.
But there's something about ostensibly being able to go outside and wander around and just being careful and not getting cornered and cut off. Like the way that Sean is obliviously and safely able to walk to and from the corner shop.
Yeah, the calmness almost, the obliviousness almost being a shield.
I think it more goes for that eeriness in the way that the John Wyndham Cozy Apocalypse thing does. It has that quiet eeriness to it.
I could see like that coziness a bit in Night of the Living Dead, where the zombies have like the caked upon makeup, the black and white having an almost calming effect, I feel, on it, right? And also with it being actually a pretty slow-paced film, you know?
It is, yeah. I think it has quite aggressive characters in it, particularly the dad. It does come across as a very 1960s buzz cut Republican type. And then Dawn of the Dead has got, you know, the two of the main characters work in the newsroom and two of them are SWAT team members.
Yeah.
Whereas Shaun of the Dead, all of the characters are fairly schlubby.
Yeah.
There's a couple of teachers, a bloke who works at electric shop. So obviously for me, it has an extra resonance because it's in an environment that I know, and it's very, very English, and I've been to Crouch End.
Yeah.
So I know that environment fairly well. And you do now too, because you've lived in London. But at the time...
I don't know. Maybe this film made me a Britophile, you know? Maybe we wouldn't have met, right? Maybe I never would have come to England. If no Shaun of the Dead. Who knows?
But watching it at the time as a Canadian, how did the Britishness strike you?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, there's lots of little mannerisms. I feel like Shaun and his mum, they're like loving, but not quite constrained, but emotionally
a bit bottled repressed.
Up. That's the word. There we go.
Yes.
Yeah. They're somewhat repressed way of dealing with each other, right? You know? Mm. And even, like, I really like the moment with his stepdad as he's dying. I think, like, I really like the bit where he said that he wanted to be a father figure to Shaun. You know, he thought that that's what Shaun needed, but he, you know, like, they just could never get to that point, right? And it's like, wow, maybe if you had this talk when Shaun was 12, right? Things could have been different, right? But no.
I think it is very much about that British repressed, emotional, not really being able to connect to your girlfriend properly, not being able to connect to your mum properly.
And also maybe the idea of kind of like avoiding conflict, which gets harder and harder the dire things get.
Yes, it's that moment where Pete, played by Peter Serafinowicz, persuades Shaun to boot Ed out of the house, and Ed's playing his computer game, and Shaun is leaning over his shoulder and very tactfully trying his best, being very conflict averse.
Yeah, the one thing that does change as I get older is I do feel like, as a teen, being like, it's not that bad. And as I get older, being like, he has less and less redeeming qualities, right?
Who, Shaun?
No, Ed.
Yes, he's really unpleasant, isn't he?
Unpleasant, like, literally dangerous with his callousness, right? You know?
Yes.
So.
Sometimes he's nice, but sometimes he's quite aggressive, and he's quite...
Well, like, just, like, it's comedic, him taking a phone call while they're surrounded by zombies, right?
Yes.
Him playing the slot machine or whatever that bar game is when they're surrounded by zombies.
Yes.
Whew, yeah.
I think it's one of those things, the older you get, the more you identify with and agree with Pete.
It's sad, but yeah.
So when you're about that age or younger, I think I was probably about that age when I saw it. And I would have been younger. I'm younger than Simon. Yeah, it's like, oh, Pete, he's so grumpy, so uptight.
Yeah.
But watching it now, it's like, it would be awful to live with
Ed. No kidding. Like, your roommates are blasting music on a work night, right?
He doesn't jot down the answer phone messages and all these awful things that he does. And he seems like a thoroughly unpleasant bloke.
Yeah. Yeah,
so. He's probably got a heart of gold, but his behavior is really,
I mean,
not very good.
Actions are where it's at, right? He totals a car just so he can drive a nicer car, when logistically that is seems like quite a mistake.
Yes, he's incredibly selfish. He's a drug dealer. He's dealing drugs
to teens?
Noel. Yes, to Noel, who's Simon's colleague, who's Shaun's colleague.
And also, I've watched this film maybe 100 times, and it was only on my most recent rewatch that I learned that Noel is played by Rafe Spall,
yes. Yeah. Oh, did you not notice before?
No, because he looks so different now.
He does, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah. I was like, wow, you can steal something, learn something new about your favourite film.
This is the first time, having watched it many, many times, that I noticed that you see Mary, who's the zombie who turns up in the garden, you see her leaving for work.
Yeah.
So she lives just close to the shop.
Right.
And on the first pass of Shaun walking to the shop, you see her, very fraction of a second, you see her coming out of her front door.
Okay, all right. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know.
So she crops up a few times throughout, and a few of these people crop up a few times. The zombies you see later, most of them... a lot of the early ones turn up as living people
right
at the start.
Yeah, I know. The recursion is fantastic. It's a lot of fun seeing the repeated instances.
Yes, this is one of the things that I wrote down, that it's... I mean, for a start, Edgar in particular, he's a master of detail. It's like every moment he has thought about, there's not a wasted inch.
Yes.
So there's a bit early on in the pub when... everyone is there. It's that very first scene in the pub. Everyone there is there, and it's getting a bit stressed. Everyone's saying, Sean, Ed, and things like that. But in the background, the sounds of the pub and the pool table just rise up. Everything. He's thought about everything really carefully.
Sean, what I'm trying to say is I need something a little more. More than spending every night in the Winchester. I want to get out there and do more interesting stuff. I want to live a little. And I want you to want to do it too. Oh, listen to me. Looking to sound like your mum. Not that I know what she sounds like.
You still haven't met his mum?
Not yet.
Don't you get along with your mum, Sean?
No, it's not that I don't get on with her.
Are you ashamed by your mum, Sean?
No, I love my mum.
Yeah, I love his mum.
Ed.
She's like butter.
Ed.
Sean.
Guys.
Sean.
Liz. Look, I understand what you're trying to say, okay? And I agree. You should get out there. We'll start tomorrow.
I love Ed's bit to Sean where he's outlining their day, you know. We'll have a bite at the King's Head, a couple of Bloody Mary, and it's outlining how, and come back here, and it's outlining the rest of the movie, right?
Yes, it prefigures the movie, doesn't it?
You know what we should do tomorrow? Keep drinking. We'll have a Bloody Mary first thing, have a bite at the King's Head, couple of the Little Princess, we'll stagger back here. Back at the bar for shots. How's that for a slice of fried gold?
So the whole thing feels really tightly choreographed. You get all these setups and payoffs, even just lines of dialogue that mean one thing at the start of the film, then mean something else at the other. So it's like the entire first half of the film is then repeated in the second half of the film with a subtly different meaning.
That the climax is a fart joke, right? That still manages to be sad. It's amazing.
And also, this is the first time I've really noticed the fact that there's the bit early on where Ed calls them zombies and Sean says, don't say that, don't say zombie. And I think that's a reference to Dawn of the Dead, because they never refer to the word, they never use the word zombie in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, yeah.
But later on, when he refers, I think it's David who refers to Sean's mum becoming a zombie, Sean says, don't say that. It's a couple of times he says, don't say that.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same dialogue mirrored, but meaning something different. So it's like the whole film takes place in like a series of different sized loops. You're waiting for that thing to pay off and recur. Yeah, like you say, it's recursion, isn't it? That it's all happening in different places. It's not concentric circles, but it's all these different sized loops and things recurring. Which is one of the reasons I think it's so watchable. It's not just a fun film about a zombie apocalypse in a central London location with likable characters mostly. It's actually intensely detailed and extremely clever.
Yeah, no, that's why I feel like I could watch it several times a year, where, yeah, you pick up new things.
Yeah, it's always something new to spot.
Yeah, and it's shot in, like, a visually interesting way, right? Film looks really good, so, yeah.
So, yeah, going back to the idea of it being British but you being Canadian, I think sort of it's kind of more the location and the tone of it, because something that, and I might have talked about this in the American Werewolf in London episode, it's something that I had this revelation a few years back whilst watching Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
Oh.
American 80s cinema, Hollywood cinema, is particularly evocative. So you've got E.T. and you've got Poltergeist and all those films, and including the John Hughes comedies.
Yeah.
Are very evocative for a British person. But then because I used to live in Chicago, I lived in Chicago for 3 months. Towards the end of Planes, Trains and Automobiles, he's standing on one of the L train stations that I knew.
Yeah.
And it suddenly occurred to me, this isn't this 1980s dream Hollywood world. For Americans watching this, this is these stories happening in their own environment. So E.T. isn't this magical suburb that only exists in E.T. and Poltergeist. This is real life to these. So for then non-British people in the other direction watching Shaun of the Dead, it must be a similar sort of experience.
Let me tell you, though, when I came to live in North London, me and my mate were not able to say, rent a house. even if we had a third person. So, yeah, I don't know if that just shows how different the London real estate market is between 2004 and 2015 when I came over, right?
But in terms of like the feel of the environment, it's a zombie apocalypse in a world that I know, but I think to people who don't live in London or didn't live in London at the time that they saw it, it would have a whole, which I think is also a reason that in the US and possibly Canada that Downton Abbey is quite a nerdy thing.
Yes, yeah.
Whereas in this country it's something that grannies watch.
Yeah, no, it's a bit, it's quite trendy.
Yeah, that's really weird.
I also appreciate with the Shaun of the Dead, it being set in a very localized version of London. There's no shots of Big Ben or the Thames, right?
That's true. I hadn't thought about that, but it's not tourist London.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, like, I love 28 Days Later, and even if they weren't looking towards, like, an international market, I think you have to have those shots of, like, empty Piccadilly Circus and Trafalgar Square. But I like that, you know, it shows a more, like, day-to-day life of London. Well, when there's a zombie apocalypse. I remember your talk there about its Britishness reminded me of something. I remember when the film was coming out, you probably remember this too, the UK promotional for it was like Sean with his flowers on a crowded subway train car, zombies packing the, yes, the train car. But for the North American, they went for a more, you know, like bland, like the movie poster zombies clawing at the movie poster.
Ah, right.
Because the idea being like, oh, a lot of cities don't have subways, or, you know, not enough of the viewing audience would kind of get the joke, or, you know, the, or be able to be like, oh yes, that's what it's like, rush hour on the London Tube.
That British version of the poster with the pressed against the glass of the tube, mm-hmm, is a reference to something, now you mention it, and I can't remember what it's something quite obscure. It's something like an Electric Light Orchestra album cover, but the back of an album cover.
Wow, okay.
Or Argent, or some I'm sure it's some 70s band.
Interesting.
And the back of the album has that image.
The album in question is the rear cover of Face the Music by Electric Light Orchestra.
We'll come to the next question. Do you have a favourite scene?
Oh boy, you know, I was mulling this over, and it's tough because I just love the whole movie, right? And I do think the movie flows so well into from one scene to the next. That's very tough for me to pick a favorite. There's definitely jokes I like.
Yes, do you have a favorite joke?
Yeah, well, like, I was thinking about it. I think there's two. One, love, pow, super mum, right? Oh, the deadpan delivery, right? Yeah. And I also really like the sight gag of, are there any zombies out there? As Sean is peering out the mailbox slot of the door, and he's like, "Nope." And then and then the camera pans just a little bit, and it's like, "Oh no, there they are! They're all just clustered outside the frame." Right?
I think also this is so rewatchable that you will laugh at different jokes, yeah, on different viewings, because you remember the ones you laughed at last times, and then other ones will bob up to the surface. So the one I laughed at, which is quite a subtle one, is they've encountered the two zombies in the garden, and then the guy, the groom going to the wedding,
yeah,
he's got an arm off,
yeah,
and then they sit down to look at the TV, and the TV news is talking about some apocalypse, and Ed says, "Do you think this is the same thing?"
Yeah, relatable. Hey, who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of relatable, I think also what grounds this so well is moments like where they're about to strike out, they're about to get in the car, go and rescue all the people who need rescuing, and Sean says, "I've got to do a wee first," which you never get in films. My favourite scene, I think, is the second long uninterrupted Steadicam shot of Sean walking from his house to the corner shop and back.
Yes, lots of good callbacks there, yeah.
Yes. Because there's the first one when it's just a normal day, and he passes all the people, has the interactions with them. Then on the second pass, everything's changed. And again, it's very cleverly done, like the guy washing his car windscreen with foam. On the way past the second time, the windscreen is broken and shattered, and it's become white
yeah.
in the same way. So it looks very similar to the way it did when it was covered in foam. So it's very intensely well done and very, very clever.
Yeah.
And the repeated motions and all the callbacks immediately afterwards. But it also, because of the music as well, watching it this time, it occurred to me how eerie that scene is. Because none of it's really played for laughs. I mean, the only laughs you'll really get from it is recognising how things have changed on the repeat. They're changed, but they're the same.
Even the jokes, even the laughs, you know, will, like, have a sinister edge. Sean not seeing the bloody handprints, you know, as he opens the
yes,
door.
Yes, he's too hungover, doesn't he?
As the young man begging for change, he's dragging now an empty leash, implying that he ate his dog, right?
So I think that's the key scene that really sets up the tone of the rest of the film. It's the end of Act One. It's not just going to be, yay, zombies, lads, yay, yeah. kind of film. It's
yeah.
it's very subtle, it's very eerie, and it's very clever as well.
I guess I do like the montage of them running through their options, right?
Yes.
And I especially like how truncated the kill Phil bit becomes.
Yes, kill Phil.
At first it's like, I'm so sorry, Philip, right? And then just sorry as a passion, right? Yeah.
I think possibly also I have to give a special shout out to the Don't Stop Me Now scene, the Queen scene. It's a genuinely exhilarating scene. It's one of the best uses of needle drop music in film, I think.
Yeah.
It's got to be up there.
Yeah, no, you can't help but kind of bounce along to it too, right? Yeah.
Yes. I think possibly it maybe ranked slightly lower because it then meant that every advert and every magazine programme had to use Don't Stop Me Now. You couldn't go a day without hearing Don't Stop Me Now for about 10 years afterwards.
It's tough, like, you know, to blame something for something's revival, right?
Yes. I mean, I love the song. It's a great song, and I think it did help Queen have yet another revival and become more recognised.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, it's Don't Stop Me Now, it's still a hit, right? But I don't know, maybe this is, again, a North America thing, but I don't know if it was on the Best of Queen tape that I would have listened to as a kid, right?
I had never heard it before, Shaun of the Dead.
Okay, yeah, so maybe
I would have
a
known
bit of a
most
deeper cut,
Queen
huh?
hits. So I think it was a later song. It was from, I think it's from Jazz? So it's not from that kind of classic Sheer Heart Attack, the Night at the Opera and Dawn of the Dead. What's the other one? Night of the Day of the Triffids albums. Day of the Racers, that's the one. So, I think people generally hadn't heard it so much as some of the more familiar ones, like
pressure,
Killer Queen. But no, you couldn't escape it for several years afterwards. But it's a genuinely exhilarating scene.
Yeah, and I'm still thinking, like, oh, what is my favourite scene? I don't know, it's tearing me apart. I can't pick one.
One thing that hadn't really occurred to me before you mentioned it earlier about the marketing and having to account for the North American market, British comedies after Four Weddings and a Funeral would have to make some kind of nod to the North American market, which this film doesn't. So they would usually have a glamorous American actress.
I know there is a small allowance they made for American viewers, very small. Mary, the zombie in the garden. You know, she turns around, she's got that glassy expression on her face. Ed and Sean look at her in horror and then laugh and say, oh my God, she's drunk.
She's so drunk. Yes, of course.
And in a commentary, Edgar writes, like, the line was originally, oh, she's pissed, right? But that is a different context.
Yes,
in North America.
Of course.
You know, everybody would be like, she's mad? No, she doesn't look angry, right? So there was some thought, a little thought,
but
right?
But it's a resolutely British film. I have no problem having American characters in it, in things for the sake of appealing
token
to
Americans.
American, or even getting some American distribution or American money. I have no problem at all with that. But it's nice that there are some films that just resolutely don't do it. And this is an entirely British film. Do you have a favourite moment?
I was kind of wanted to save this for give her a better shout out. But I do like when they are having the Mexican standoff in the bar, and it devolves into them kind of hashing out who likes whom, and David not getting over kind of his crush on Liz. Again, very British, very impressed.
Yes.
And Diane saying it straight out that she knows David liked Liz and that they only hooked up because Liz rejected him, but that she's okay with that. But David then not addressing Di, but addressing Liz, and you get a shot of Diane looking devastated. You know, a nice little moment that would have been easy to kind of skip over.
And that actually reminds me, there's a good example of Simon and Edgar's insane attention to detail. And I only noticed on this viewing, is that they all call Liz something different. Diane calls her Elizabeth, David calls her Lizzie, and Sean calls her Liz.
Interesting.
And it's got to be one of those things that's deliberate, and it's just another little touch. It's just that they have to have every moment of the film has some
meaning,
detail,
some deeper, significance.
Something. I think my favourite moment in the film, I mean, there's two parallel ones that are very close together. It's the very, very start, just as the logos fade up. The first one is you see the Universal Studios logo, and it's not the Universal Music, it's the snatch of Goblin. I think it's a Goblin track called Zombie.
Correction, it's actually a track called Figment by Simon Park, the eye level guy.
You hear kind of the wobbly synthesizer come up just as the Universal logo. And then a couple of seconds later after that, it happens again when the working title logo comes up and you get the swirly, siren-y sound, the background sound at the very beginning of Ghost Town by The Specials. So it's just those two lovely moments that really, oh right, I'm settling in, the film starting, and right from the very start you get just a great bit of sound design and music choice that really gets you straight into the film.
It is nice when the film creators are able to subvert the opening with purpose, right?
And I think it's a testament to the film that Ghost Town by The Specials, I now only associate with this film. This is a song I'm old enough to remember Ghost Town when it came out. It's a very popular song. It was a big hit at the time. It got memorably used in Father Ted, so there's every chance that it would be associated with that. But no, it's been claimed, at least in my brain, by Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely the touchstone. Yeah.
Another line I liked, Ed says about Mary in the garden, "What's up with her eyes?" And it's not a funny line, it's just, there's a few lines that take the situation absolutely seriously, even though they're comedic characters.
Ed, just get off me! Jeez! What's up with her eyes?
There's a scene that I wanted to get your vibe on, because rewatching it. So after Mary's in the garden, I think by this point the big guy has also shown up, and Sean is trying to call 911, and Ed is telling him, you know, ask if a ambulance, a fire truck, anything with the flashing red lights. And it's the only scene in the movie where Ed is seemingly worried. And I'm like, and I don't know, it feels a little out of character.
Oh.
You know, for such a well-conceived, constructed film, for him to at this point not just be light him if you got him, kind of his usual self.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he seems fairly alarmed early on.
Okay. When over the initial surprise, maybe, but then consistent scaredness afterwards.
He's quite blasé, isn't
he? Yeah, yeah.
So, even then, he's not really in a panic. He's still
concerned, though. And for me, that feels like an out-of-character scene/moment.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, that's interesting.
This is going to be my theory. I have nothing to base this on.
Right.
But I'm going to chalk this up to maybe they shot that scene early, you know? maybe it's a danger of a, you know, like, you only need the two actors. You don't shoot films chronologically. I'm just going to make a theory. Maybe they shot that. And then after that, decided, no, Ed's never kind of going to be outright scared, you know?
I had not noticed that about Ed, but I think you're right. He's usually fairly blasé, isn't he? Blasé to the point of disinterested. And I think one of my favourite elements is the fact that he has a crush on Sean's mum.
Yeah, I do like his rare good moments are seemingly his genuine distress over Barbara, you know, being bitten.
And speaking of Sean's mum, it's been a running joke in my family ever since the sitcom Ever Decreasing Circles that Penelope Wilton looks like my mum.
I've met your mum. Yeah, she does.
down to the fact that in both Ever Decreasing Circles and Shaun of the Dead, my mum's contemporary hairstyle was exactly the same as Penelope Wilton's. But also, Penelope Wilton's character in this is quite similar to my mum. I didn't want to be a bother.
Yes.
They were quite bitey.
Very sweet, good hostess, you know.
She's done very well. I think often people don't know what to do with the mum character. Even something like The Simpsons with Marge, who's a long-running character who they've been apparently writing for decades, they're still never quite sure what to do with her.
Hey, and when there's, in the heyday, when there were good Marge episodes, some of the funniest stuff, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and I like her flashes of impatience with Sean. You know, you did call him a you-know-what.
Yeah, she's a rounded character. None of the characters are outright flat ciphers. They all have depth and sides to them. One thing I was going to mention, actually, I think possibly for newer audiences or younger people, watching something like Shaun of the Dead or Spaced perhaps wouldn't be able to really appreciate how new and different it was to fill your film, your TV show, with references to other things, because it's so overplayed now.
Yeah, yeah.
And having a Star Wars reference in your thing is just every second person does it.
It felt tired even in the Alien movie that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost did. Yeah, you know, and when they were one of the earlier peoples doing it. You can't keep doing it.
You've got, not American Dad, what's it called? You've got Seth MacFarlane. Family Guy. So you've got an entire Family Guy that you can buy on DVD that's just doing the story of Star Wars. And you've got Robot Chicken on Adult Swim doing Star Wars jokes. So it's quite a thing now that I think my generation, Gen X, spent a while not really talking about these things. Talking about Star Wars and all the nerdy things we grew up... You wouldn't think it now, because you can't shut us up about it.
I was going to say...
The fact that I've got two podcasts. I think until around that time, until around about Spaced... It wasn't really mentioned, and we were going more on the previous generation's model of being a bit hand-wavy about these things. Now, if you get a stand-up comedian who mentions Star Wars, they'll know all the names of the characters. They'll know who Chewbacca is and what his personality is, that kind of thing. But if you go back to Spaceballs, the Mel Brooks film, that's very hand-wavy. Like, he's not going to sully himself by actually doing specific Star Wars jokes. He's keeping it well at a distance. So I think Spaced, in its way, was a license for us to go, oh, we can make jokes about this. We can have fun with our love of Star Wars and the things we grew up with as children, and our, you know, we can make podcasts about old TV to our heart's content. So I think that sort of was almost part of the thing that gave us permission. It's now try shutting us up.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that is the shift in pop culture of the idea of, like, the nerds have won. And on one hand, that's great. I'm glad to have, you know, a bit more of a common language. But I'm also, you know, like, well, this leads to just, like, every movie in theaters being a Marvel movie, you know?
That's true. Yes.
Like, this, you know, every, oof, you know, like, multiple Star Wars TV shows that I'm not watching, right?
No,
you know,
no.
And like, no shade on people who enjoy them. I'm, you know, like, that's great. It's just, oh, now that it is the norm, it doesn't, aside, like, I wouldn't even say, like, it doesn't feel so special. it just doesn't feel so good. But I think also, like, once something is starting to be produced in greater quantities, you're going to maybe start seeing a decrease in quality just based on you're going to miss a lot of shots.
It's definitely now that Star Wars has gone from being this thing that we had three of, and we dreamed of the day that there might be more, and then got a rude awakening in the late 90s when there was, and it didn't come close to living up to our dreams and hopes for the future.
But yes, I know, like, with space, I guess there's, like, I don't know, commentary tracks pointing out all the references, and I'd like to watch those sometime. And even, like, there's, like, a Pulp Fiction reference, right?
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference very early on in the first episode.
Yeah, you know,
episode.
So I feel like they really were throwing a lot at the wall. There's an episode that the paintball episode, I think, ends with a Terminator reference for kind of no reason. It's just the end joke, you know?
And I think now we might eye-roll if people do that kind of thing, but yeah, back then it was a brand new thing. They're doing a Star Wars reference, and not just saying, you know, because Friends did the Star Wars thing of having
a sexual fantasy of Leia.
Have Jennifer Aniston dressing up as Princess Leia. But this had a really deep cut reference of the line reading, even was similar to the way that the actor did it in Star Wars. So it was a lot more of a specific reference. Also, famously, this film was pitched as a Zom rom-com.
Ah, yes, this is on my notes to talk about.
Really? Okay. I wonder if your take on it will be different or the same
as mine. Well, I wanted to ask, because just now, looking at the posters, if it was marketed as a rom-com with Zoms in the UK, or whether just the strength of the initial premise was enough to carry it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was a later thing that they thought of and thought, oh, that's a fun gag, we'll call it a rom-zom-com. The only reason I say that is because it's not really a rom-com.
I was going to say that, like, as far as the romantic element, I think the actress for Liz is great, and I think she and Sean have chemistry, but it feels more of a buddy chemistry.
Well, I think also the story of him trying to win Liz back is just part of the human drama. I think it doesn't have the rom-com trope. So I think there's two types of rom-com. The first type is where it's two people meet each other for the first time and they hate each other.
The meet cute,
where they hate each other or they like each other, but there's some major adversity going on that they have to overcome.
Yeah.
The second one, which this one ostensibly is that it's two characters who split up, and it's usually one wants to win the other one back. It's usually for older, like rom-coms for slightly older people. It's usually like an ex, you know, the ex-wife or the ex-husband. But the trope in a rom-com, which I think makes it a rom-com, is that there has to be an antagonist. She's got a new fiancé, he's a lot more successful, but he's not very nice. And there's no actual antagonist in this, in terms of that. The only antagonist is either, you could say, it's Liz herself, who's just refusing to take Sean back, or it's Sean himself, because he's such a loser that she wouldn't want to take him back. So I think even David,
I mean,
who,
like, there's, yeah, I was going to say David.
But he's not a serious antagonist because she doesn't like him. So she'd never go out with him anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's just a comedy drama that involves, it involves getting on with your stepdad and your relationship with your mum. It involves your, you know, relationship with a girlfriend and breaking up with her and trying to win her back. So I think it's not a rom-com. I think it's a zom-com.
Well, like, there's hardly any element of romance. They do not even smooch, right?
No, they don't actually do that.
They
no...
do not smooch, you know, like, what? Yeah, so I don't know what that's all about, you know.
They do actually, yeah, when you see them at the end, they are essentially just flatmates.
Yeah, like, and they are, like, I like the little bit where Sean has the line, like, well, you don't want to die single, do you?
Right? Yes.
Like, that's, you know, I'm sweet and cute, but if you thought you were about to die, maybe you'd give your on-again, off-again partner a little smooch, right?
Yeah. You know?
I know Ed's there, but yeah. I actually think this kind of carries forth into Hot Fuzz, where initially they had been writing the script with a female love interest as a character, but it just kind of cluttering up the script, and they ended up cutting that character and giving her lines to Nick Frost's character, right?
I must admit, and this is no disrespect to Edgar Wright or Simon Frost, Simon Pegg, whatever they're called.
Keep that in.
I think actually one of... I'll start again. This is meant to no disrespect at all to Edgar Wright, but I think possibly his weakness is love interests. Baby Driver, she's entire, and it's a very well-known actress. I forget who it is. Actually, I haven't seen it for a while.
Yeah,
but it's someone who's gone on to do a lot of films. But that character is almost entirely forgettable, and she's almost entirely redundant and doesn't really have much to do.
Yeah, no, I think the actress does a good job. But like I feel like the details that we get of her backstory are kind of there to explain why she could go on the run with Baby Driver, right?
Yes, and I think possibly she's in there because it's an American film and you don't have necessarily the artistic freedom to say, no, I'm not having a romantic interest in there. So I think for all his many strengths...
I mean, like, in Baby Driver, I think having a love interest makes sense because it kind of being like a crime drama and, like, aside from his own personal reservations, some motivation to get out of that criminal life, starting over with someone would be a good reason. I rewatched last night in Soho because I don't know if with love interests, if you're specifically mean female love interests, but the love interest in Last Night in Soho, again, the actor does a great job, but the details we get, there are things where the main character, Ellie, is like, you must think I'm crazy, don't you? Right? And him being
he's a little bit cursory as well, isn't he?
And he's like, no, my auntie believes some weird shit, so I'm totally buying. And it's like, anything we get from him is usually in response to, why would he be going along with this?
It's nice that it's a male character this time rather than a female character.
Yeah, so it does show that it's like kind of equal opportunity.
Yes, it's not that Edgar can't do female characters. It's just his strength isn't love interests.
I was relieved, though, with Last Night in Soho. When I first saw the trailer, I was like, ooh, interesting. A female main character from Edgar Wright. But I do know that there was also a woman who wrote the script with him. So I think that's, it's smart. If there's something that, a perspective you lack, to bring someone else in, right?
But I think the female characters in this are very good. I think all three female characters are not... they're not weak, and I think it is just having to have the love interest.
Yeah.
Cameos. We got some good cameos in this. There's a whole... They get all the... Most of the cameos, they just get out in a few seconds. They put them all in a long line. Martin Freeman, Rhys Shearsmith, Tamsin Gregg, Julia Deakin from Spaced, Matt Lucas just file past the camera, which is quite nice, quite neat.
Jessica Stevenson. I guess she goes by Jessica Hines now.
Yes. Is she a cameo or is she like a minor character?
She's got spoken lines, but I mean, three, I guess. Yeah.
She turns up three times. I'd say she's a minor character. I think they wanted her to be in it and possibly they'd maybe written Liz for her, but she was unavailable.
Okay. She also would have been a good die, but I mean, I love Lucy Davis's die.
Yes, her very vague way of talking, and often I can't quite tell what she's saying. She sort of throws away the lines, but it really works. The scene when they're walking through the zombies is as scary as anything in any horror film, I think.
Yeah, though that scene kind of bothers me because...
Oh, really?
Well, one thing I appreciate is some sense of how zombies operate. You got zombies that are based solely on sound. You got some that are based on smell. So without a clear sense of how these zombies sense their prey, I'm a little like, how do the characters know this is going to work? Like, it's a pretty big risk to take based on what? Nothing, So it feels like kind of a bad move from characters who have been relatively cautious, if not all that smart. I get like they need some way to get to the Winchester, but it kind of takes me out of the film a little bit because I don't feel like they are following their own logic.
I suppose there's a bit of cinematic shorthand going on.
Yeah.
Of just sort of having to make the assumption guessing it's going to work, hoping it's going to work.
Yeah.
I like the gag of one of the characters saying, we're not going to get anywhere by moaning.
Yes, yeah.
A ding light bulb moment.
Yeah.
That's a nice show. But the actual scene itself, regardless of the logic of it, when they're actually walking through the zombies, and that is good, eerie filmmaking. I love Barbara's high pitched,
yeah, her like, attempts just, like, at moaning. Tight-lipped. Yeah. Yeah. I do like There's a little bit of, like, you see David briefly kind of hurting Di and Liz in a way that's like, oh, you know, he does care for them on some level, right? Trying to shield them from zombies. So.
I think actually the only bit that doesn't really work for me is at the end of that when they're holed up against the side of the pub and the zombies are just waiting for them to do the things they need to do and they don't.
Yeah.
They've got quite a long time to do anything they need to do before the zombies attack.
Yeah.
They should have been dead within seconds of arriving at the pub. But it's a comedy film.
Yeah, I do like the logic of Sean just being loud enough to distract all the zombies.
Is there a bit or an element that you could do without in the film?
Well, I talked about how wanting the, you know, romance maybe to be amped up a little bit. I don't know if I have too much to go over that haven't already been brought up. Yeah, how about you?
I mean, there's a couple of things. You probably wouldn't these days have Nick Frost using a certain racial epithet.
Oh my gosh, good point. Yeah, yeah.
The thing I could really do without every time I watch it is Sean getting a dart in his head.
You know,
it's funny, but I really...
It always makes me cringe. I especially like just the, again, who are the real enemies? Who's the real danger?
In the head, in the head.
Yeah, and I love the practical effect of it. Like the scene where he pulls it out, you know, he pulls out the, like, it's the trick dart with the blood spurting out. His hand goes out of frame. A special effects person hands him a real dart, which he then holds up and shakes in the frame. Just a nice little practical, you know, effect. At least, yeah, I guess for the actual, like, throwing part is just an editing thing, right? You get the shot of the dart being thrown. He ducks his head. He comes back screaming, you know.
Yes, I think a lot of the projectiles are CG as well. A lot of the records that they throw at the zombies towards the start are CG records.
Okay, I know, like, the household items just made of, like, foam and rubber, but I didn't know that about the records.
I wouldn't take it out of the film, but it's the bit that, it's the bit that I personally could do without seeing every time I watch the film, because that does make it. It's a lot of horror films I can put up with the horror because it's so cartoonish and so full on.
Yeah.
In John Carpenter's The Thing, I can cope with the entire film apart from the bit where they're using a scalpel to cut their thumbs to get blood samples.
Wow.
I can't watch that. I can watch things bursting out of chests. I can watch heads coming off and crawling away.
Yeah.
But I can't watch...
Yeah, but anything real, huh?
Anything real. Anything you can imagine, I think.
Yeah.
Anything you can empathise with.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that final third in the pub, that's as exciting and frightening as anything you'll see in any other horror film. I think that's a good... It's very much like Assault on Precinct 13, the original John Carpenter one. Have you seen Assault on Precinct 13?
I have not.
It's very like that.
Okay.
Very similar feel. I recommend it highly. The music,
okay.
Even, I mean...
I love Carpenter synth.
Yeah, I think the music is very redolent of it, so there's no reason to suspect it's not at least a semi-deliberate variation on Assault on Precinct 13.
No, I definitely think, often see people discussing whether Shaun of the Dead, if it's more of a straight-up comedy than a horror, but I think it's very true to the zombie genre by having that... shades of nihilism in that final act, right?
Yeah, and I really appreciate a film that can do a proper climactic last stand where it feels really apocalyptic and the characters start getting killed off one by one and it starts seeming really desperate.
Even when they are momentarily saved by seemingly random chance, the shells heating up from the fire.
Yes.
it doesn't feel cheap because, again, things have been set up and it only buys them a momentary reprieve. So,
yes, exactly.
And with the final act, it gives a way for Ed to redeem himself in a way that still fits his slacker character, right?
Yeah.
He's doing it because on some level he does care about Sean, but he also just, you know, can't be bothered. He's been bit. Rather just stay sitting where he is.
One of my favourite gags is the bit, because it's quite a sensitive and emotional moment where Liz and Sean are talking about how there's only two bullets left and they might need to use the bullet on themselves. And the bit where Sean mimes having to do it, including the brains.
Yeah.
But he's very seriously going through each of the actions.
How many shells have we got left?
too. I suppose we could, you know, take a few of them out if they stand in a line.
I wasn't thinking about them.
I know. What about Ed? There's only two shells.
I don't mind being eaten.
How are we gonna do this?
I don't know. One of us has to go first.
Well, maybe one should do the other and then do themselves.
Oh, maybe you should do me. I'll only muck it up if I have to do myself.
I think part of the zombie resurgence of the early 2000s, you know, I don't know, you spend time thinking like, oh yeah, would I be able to say, kill my family if they were turned into zombies, right?
Mm.
Two characters discussing like, oh no, you should do it. I would just mess it up, right?
I like that Liz is given a personality and she's not just the girl. She feels like a real person.
I like her line in the lead up to her dumping Sean where she's like, oh, I just feel like if I don't get my act together,
if I don't do something,
if I, you know, nothing will change. And Sean's like, what do you mean do something? So, you know, just like showing the understanding gap, right? You can't, you know, it's too wide to kind of make it work at that point, right?
One of the criticisms of the film at the time was that tonally, the bit with zombie mum didn't fit in with the rest of the film.
It is a bit of tonal whiplash.
It's a bit of tonal whiplash, but I think the film needs it because it needs that depth. I think it makes it a more rounded experience and a deeper experience to have those layers. And I think it would be a shallow film if it was just a zombie comedy.
Yeah, for
if it's
sure.
Just, if it's just wall-to-wall comedy, wall-to-wall laughs.
Yeah, it wouldn't stick, right?
Mm. And I think like the best horror comedies like American Werewolf in London, the comedy comes from the characters. So it isn't just gags. It's not like Airplane.
Yeah.
Although a zombie Airplane might be quite fun.
Oh,
but
my goodness. Yeah, yeah. Just go all in on it, yeah.
But it probably wouldn't be very scary. It probably wouldn't be a very good horror film.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Because the whole thing of comedy releasing tension, making it especially tough to get the horror comedy, right?
Yes, I think it works better as a juxtaposition, particularly in American Werewolf in London, where you're sitting through the comedy and that's building up the tension of when the horror is going to come back. And this doesn't alternate comedy and horror in the same way that American Werewolf does it. It's a kind of it integrates it more. I'm not saying better because I think it actually really works in American Werewolf that it alternates.
This is not an American Werewolf podcast episode because I have thoughts on that movie, but tell me if you think this is maybe a good read. American Werewolf being a horror comedy, this being a comedy horror.
Yes, I think that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, kind of just about where the balance shifts and both having elements of both, but where the emphasis is.
It's one of Edgar's very favorite films as well,
oh.
So I know he was very influenced by that.
That would make sense.
But it's definitely approaching horror comedy from a different angle, but still getting the balance exactly right, still having enough horror and enough comedy separate from each other, and not infecting each other, not diluting each other in any way.
Yeah.
So I'd not really thought about that before I said it. The idea of American Werewolf alternating horror and comedy, and this blends them.
Yeah.
Has them running side by side at least. So they don't get mixed up, but they run side by side. This is never just funny, and it's never, rarely just horror. It's occasionally the jokes, or the humour of it stops a bit, but you've always got the quite fun characters. The characters in this are more overtly comedic than they are in American Werewolf. This is less of a straight drama with fun characters. This is more of a comedy.
Yeah, you know, people and their foibles, right?
Yes. Yes, you wouldn't get a character like Ed in American Werewolf. The closest you get is Griffin Dunne's character, who's nothing like Ed at all. He's just sort of like the cheeky best mate.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, they're not in any way similar.
Yeah. I mean, like, there is a grim stretch of the film. With the zombie mum, there's still some jokes. There's still some, we're not saying the Z word.
Still plenty of references to films.
Yeah. But after she's shot, there's the bit with David, you know, and his attempt to just straight up shoot Sean. Which again, who's the real enemy? Who's the real danger? Your fellow humans! And his subsequent being torn apart, which is kind of comedic almost in its extreme gruesomeness. And then I feel like we get a little bit of the joke back to the jokes with Di using his leg as a cudgel, and she strides into a horde of zombies to rescue him, right? Even though at this point we've seen his head detach from his ripped apart body.
I know.
Yeah.
And according to the deleted scenes, she survives. But I don't
yes.
like that. I think it's part of the grim last stand that you have to kill off the characters.
I mean, I don't want her necessarily... I don't necessarily want to see her die, but I do kind of like it, the idea of it being ambiguous.
Yeah, I think it would be disappointing for there to be a coda in Butch and Sundance, for example, for a little thing of them hiding up a tree, going, oh, we made it!
Yeah, yeah.
I like that ambiguity of it's desperate, and you're just assuming the characters are getting killed off one by one, and so I think they wisely took that idea out that she did get through the zombies and hit up a
yeah,
tree.
Yeah, no, it's only a DVD extra, you can just, and up to you to decide how canon those are, right?
I'm saying non-canon.
Yeah, yeah.
The only other thing I have to say is that the very end of the film gives you a glimpse of horrible early 2000s daytime TV.
You know, one of those DVD extras shows that they had a Coldplay cameo that they didn't even put in the film.
Yeah, the two of Coldplay do appear briefly. Final couple of questions here. Who wins your award for outstanding person in front of the camera?
Let's see. Even though saying that maybe Jessica Stevenson could have replaced her, I do think Lucy Davis's Di took what could have been a thankless role. You know, makes her very cute, vulnerable, maybe shades of, like, this person could be annoying to be around, but still sympathetic.
Yes, she turns a minor character into a very memorable character.
I think Dylan Moran, good job with David. It seems almost such a waste, though, that he's not playing a more comedic character. Such a funny guy, right?
But it's good to see him's got range, because you almost don't think he's the... I mean, you don't really think he's the same guy as Bernard Black from Black Books.
Right.
Like, that's not the same guy.
Yeah.
So it shows that... For a stand-up comedian, he's got acting range. He can play
That's
different
true.
Characters.
Yeah. But I think, like, I remember listening to the actor's commentary and him being the funniest one, right?
Yes.
But sometimes you got to step back and let the stars get the laughs. That's a team player, I guess.
Yeah. Well, my nomination is, and this is bearing in mind that I think there isn't a weak performance in the whole thing. I think everyone is very strong. I'm going to say Penelope Wilton, though.
Oh, yeah.
I think because she gives it, she has a lot of layers, and I think she's bringing the experience and the class, and she's done. Oh, she was in Clockwise as well, which is another one of the classic British comedies. But I think playing that role, she could have been a very one-dimensional, corny mum character. But she's not. She's very believable, and
Yeah. She's
good at the light comedy, but also she's good at bringing that quiet, repressed English dignity to it.
The joke of where they're practicing being zombies, and Di's like, Barbara, very good.
Yes. Right? Oh, sorry, I was she's miles
like,
away.
Yeah, and like because at that point, you know, her husband has been turned into a zombie, right? She's hiding a bite. You know, the world's gone to hell. You know, like, just caught in, like, a moment almost of that showing through, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what makes her particularly good, is that she has to have that whole chunk of the film with a secret.
Yeah.
Which I think none of the other characters really do, particularly. I mean, there's the idea that David is really in love with Liz.
But that's pretty, you know, like, called out early on.
Yeah, that's fairly obvious early on. But she's carrying this secret, so her vagueness and her sort of her comedic traits of being a bit all
deluded,
over the place and
like
being a bit
tampered down. Yeah, and then
you find out that she's been hiding this, the fact that she's been fatally bitten. And
it's also a nice subversion, because I feel like in a lot of zombie movies, the person hiding a bite is usually somebody already unsympathetic to the audience.
Yes.
Versus here, I don't think I've ever watched this film and felt mad at Barbara, right?
No.
For hiding the bite. Whereas in a lot of movies, you're like, hey, you put everybody at risk.
Yes,
and for what?
It's the sneaky, cowardly character, isn't it?
To put off the inevitable, right? You should have owned up to it from the moment it happened, you know?
But actually, you probably would hide it in the hope that they find some kind of cure.
Oh, totally. To stay with your friends and family. Yeah, yeah.
And then also, it's a very clever thing that in retrospect, you feel bad about laughing at certain jokes, like the joke of Barbara looking looking a bit vacant, and Diana saying, "Oh, very well done." She says, "Oh, sorry, I was miles away." And you know, she's just been bitten a few minutes earlier, and so she's got a lot on her plate. She's got a lot on her mind. So then you look back on these things and you feel bad. Oh, I laughed at that, but actually, that's the precursor to this tragic finale.
This isn't a performance, but I want to shout out Bill Nye. When I worked at a gallery in London, he'd come in, always a nice guy.
Well, that's good to know.
The staff, we wouldn't, you know, approach him because we were professional. But I know, like, I saw, like, patrons be like, "Can my girlfriend take a picture with you?" And he'd say, "Of course," right?
Well, that's good. He's a proper gent. So this one's obviously a bit trickier because you don't see them. But who wins your award for outstanding person behind the camera?
Yeah. Now, I haven't looked into exactly who did this, but I do think the special effects really good. I don't think this film looks low budget. I don't know what its budget was, but a first-time filmmaker, a British film, I can't imagine it being substantial.
No, I think it would just be a handful of million.
Yeah, I think overall, the special effects, fantastic. I was talking about this practical effect of the dart. The only thing that maybe looks a little dodgy is, like, the quick cuts of the military showing up at the end. But I can imagine you might have to do some creative staging to get across the scale of that, you know?
Yes. So my award, and this is taking Edgar Wright for Red, I think. I'm saying Chris Dickens, the editor.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah.
So, I mean, I think probably, obviously, it's Edgar Wright, but I can't just say the director for every occasion, so I'm saying the editor.
I also think we should, as a society, try to get rid of the auteur theory. I think, straight up, a lot of evil has come from the idea of one creative vision creating a film.
We, as we're discovering, more and more stories come out, not about Edgar Wright, luckily, and he does seem like a proper team player. He's the glue holding it all together, and he has a lot of the stylistic ideas.
And having seen every film he's made, it does have a vision and distinctive style. But there's, of course, always people behind the scenes who have contributed to that.
Obviously, you edit closely with the director, so this isn't the editor imposing his style on top of the film, but I think...
Well, I know, but when Tarantino, when his long-term editor, and I forget her name,
Sally Menke, or Menke.
But him saying that she was kind of the only one, as far as the production side of things goes, that he considered, like, a collaborator. He'd be writing it, he'd be directing it, but it was only once it got to the editing room that somebody else was kind of putting their own touch on it, right? And I don't know how widely appreciated outside of film that is known. I could ask you some silly questions that you could cut out.
All right, then, go on.
Oh, boy. Okay. Do you think you'd do well in a zombie apocalypse?
I think I would. I think I'd be great.
Oh, I like this confidence. That's good.
I'd be bad at violence. Yes. I'm quite squeamish.
Mm.
But I think I'd be quite good at not getting caught. I can be quite wily.
Oh, okay, all right, I like it. Good, good.
I grew up in the countryside. I grew up in Lincolnshire, spending a lot of my childhood staying out of the way of farmers whilst trespassing.
Nice.
Playing on the farmyards.
Turning those figures into zombies, you're golden.
How about you, though? How do you think you're doing that?
See, I think I'd be good until the people I care about started dying, right? You know? Yeah, I'd be a big bummer.
That would be a bummer.
And maybe lose the will to live in this zombie world. So, yeah, tricky, yeah. I really enjoyed discussing my favorite movie, Shaun of the Dead.
It's your absolute favorite movie, do you think?
It's definitely up there. As I said, I've changed, and so I've seen a lot more movies since I've seen this one, you know, and because I've changed, it's still up there. I've still probably watch it every couple of years, just not several times a year, like when I was younger. And after thinking it over, I do think Return of the Living Dead is my favorite zombie movie. So.
Right. I think for me, if I come home from the pub and I've had a few, and I fancy watching a film that I've seen lots of times before, and it's a nice easy watch. It's either going to be this or A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, good comfort movie,
That's normally the circumstances where I watch either of those two films.
Yeah, I can see that.
And if it's on telly, well, if either of them are on telly, I'll usually stay.
Yeah, sure, that's just fate.
So before we go, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, well, I am a author, and I had a historical fantasy novel that came out last year. It's called Innate Magic. You could ask your local bookstore to order it in, or you can find it online. Actually, the sequel, External Forces, is coming out this winter, so now is a good time to read the first book.
Give us a bit of a quick premise.
Yeah, sure. So it's set in 1950s England, but in a world where magic exists, and the main character, Paul Gallagher, he's a Liverpool lad trying to make a go of it in London. He makes magic clothes for a living. But he also has this secret illegal magic that he can do. And when somebody, this man in the military, finds out about it, a man that Paul kind of like forms a little bit of a crush on because he's the type to fall easily when he meets someone he's attracted to. And when this military man kind of wants to use Paul's power for his own ends, he's in a bit of a pickle, right? It puts his friends and family in danger, and he has to get out of that spot.
That sounds very intriguing.
Thank you.
And if people are interested, where can they get in touch?
I'm on Twitter. Shannon L. Fay is my handle there. I've got a website, ayearonsaturn.com, but I'm pretty bad at about updating it, so you can still check it out. Yeah.
And Fay is just F-Y-I. F-A-Y-F-Y-I. Fay is just F-A-Y, no E.
Correct. Yeah, the Fays with the E's got nothing to do with them.
Splitters. Well, thank you, Shannon. And thank you, listeners, for pressing your ear to the podcast wall and eavesdropping on our conversation. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find my sibling podcast, RetroTube Archive Television Podcast, on Twitter at Retro_Tube, where my co-host Heather also lives. And if you want to send actual email communication, the address is RetroTubePodcast@gmail.com. I'll be back soon with another guest and another film. But until then, goodbye.